Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome back to Working Overtime, the advicey scrappy-doo to working Scooby. I'm Isaac Butler.
And I'm June Thomas. What are we talking about today, Isaac?
I'm not going to lie. Today's topic may be a little weird.
Weird topics are my favorite topics.
Okay, great. Well, you may remember a few weeks ago in Working Overtime, because I know you religiously listen to the show, even the ones you are not on.
Indeed.
Karen Hahn and I were talking about audience. You know, who's the intended audience for your work? How much should you think about that? And, you know, one thing we talked about briefly was the audience of the future. What would people years from now, or maybe even after we're dead, think of our work? And that got me wondering, actually, what will they think about it, you know? And should we worry about that? And are we writing for our present time or for posterity? So how does the future figure in to the creative process?
For me, at least, as something that is likely to create a writer's block. I mean, it's bad enough to just have to meet deadlines without adding anxiety about the needs and tastes of readers decades down the line. Are you crazy?
That is true. But the reason why I thought I want to talk about this with June is, you know, I know you're a big fan of Oliver Berkman's 4,000 Weeks.
And
he was a guest on the podcast. And, you know, it's a book entirely about how the knowledge that we have limited time on the earth should actually be freeing and should shape our productivity instead of creating paralysis.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering about, is there something there that we can use for our own creativity? You know, is there some way of thinking about future readers that might actually help us?
You know, I haven't necessarily thought about it for my own writing, but as someone whose journalism has mostly appeared on the internet.
Mine too.
Yeah, I do sometimes worry how and sometimes even if what we're making will be preserved. I mean, in the early days of Slate, we used to publish a weird thing called Slate on Paper, which collected a week's worth of the magazine's content into a printed magazine. And it was mostly a sort of sop to old school readers who weren't comfortable with the internet because, remember, Slate started in 1996. And as someone who was very much involved with the production of Slate on Paper, I can tell you it was a pain in the ass to make. However, when I look at the two or three copies that I still have, it does make me realize, like, it allowed you to see what was going on in the magazine that week, who was on the staff that week. Those aren't things that you can really figure out on the web. The internet is a fleeting, ephemeral place.
Yes, that's definitely true. And, you know, it's getting more and more ephemeral. That's the thing. You know, we used to think about everything's going to live on the internet forever. It's going to be this kind of infinite Borgesian archive, you know, and that's going to preserve our culture. But it's actually not true. If anything, is as it becomes more owned by mega corporations, more and more stuff gets memory hold.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, you and I are both, among other things, cultural historians, right? We are trying to actually take things that might get forgotten and place them in a narrative context along with the rest of our culture so that they illuminate our culture and our culture illuminates them, et cetera. And so I think this is something you and I might think about a lot, right? Mm. But at the same time, how many works of cultural history are still read 50 years after they're written? Like, we are trafficking, actually, in an art form that the culture industry does not seem particularly invested in preserving.
Yeah, no, it's so true. Not as many as most writers would like are going to be still being talked about in 50 years' time, still being read. And, you know, partly that's down to publishers. The books they keep in print are the ones we read, and the ones they keep in print are the ones that are read. But that doesn't necessarily correlate in quality or intrinsic interest. There are so many systemic factors at play. Today, we can find some out-of-print books for purchase on the internet. We can find some in libraries. But I do wonder if there'll be some universal access system at some point in the near future where we will be able to make sure that nothing gets absolutely memory holed, but I don't really know if that's going to happen.
My idea is that eventually they will be able to beam to us the memory of having experienced a work of art without us having to do it, right? So it'll be like the memory of seeing the movie instead of the movie itself. And that way, things will live on in this sort of weird, weird way. Probably not within our lifetime, though. So, June, you know, it does actually turn out that we are not alone in thinking about this. A few people have very recently been writing about posterity and changing trends in art and audience, and I will actually be talking with one of them after this.
What's the best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day in everyday situations. But if that's not on the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. I've used apps in the past to learn new languages, but when I came across Babbel, I wondered if it could help me refresh my knowledge of a language I once spoke well, but was now a little bit or quite a lot rusty. I have to say, I was impressed. The advanced lessons were really useful, tips and idioms that can help with in-depth conversations on topics that I can actually imagine chatting about. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel is designed by real people for real conversations, and the tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. What's more, all of Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by their 20-day money-back guarantee. Here's a special limited-time deal for working listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for working listeners, at babbel.com/working. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/working, spelled BABBEL.com/working. Rules and restrictions may apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hey, listeners, do you have any tips or questions about the creative process? If so, get in touch and share your advice or the dilemmas that you want us to help with. You can email us at working@slate.com, or even better, you can call us and leave a message at 304-933-9675. That's 304-933-WORK.
Welcome back to Working Overtime. So my mom, who's a big fan of the show, often sends me text messages with, you know, little notes after she listens to the episode. She sent me this very charming piece in the Washington Post by Michael Dierda, their long-serving book critic, about what books will last. Because it turns out, 25 years ago, he wrote a piece about which authors are going to stand the test of time and still be relevant 25 years later. And he revisits that list and talks with good humor about what he got right and what he got wrong. And he got a lot of things right, I should say. But there are other ones, you know, that were big assumptions back then in the 90s and just didn't pan out. For example, you know, all those big deal straight male writers of suburban ennui, no one gives a shit about them anymore.
Yeah, I cannot say I am heartbroken to hear those bits of news.
That's probably true. But anyway, he wrote a list of things that authors could do if they want to make sure their work survives into posterity. Okay, so drum roll, please. Here are the tips. 1, write first-rate genre fiction, whether it's mystery, fantasy, or romance. 2, be sure to produce one big masterpiece suitable for the classroom.
Done.
3, build a fan base among the young. 4, find a publisher willing to keep your books readily available. 5, dominate some niche better than anyone else. So long as people lose themselves in Regency romances, they will always read Georgette Heyer. Well, so that seems easy, right?
Yeah, piece of cake.
Yeah. Let's just get right on writing our genre masterpiece that will be read in classrooms, right?
Exactly.
But I do wonder if the lesson here for our creative process, for everyone's creative process, is maybe you just shouldn't think about this at all. Like, you can't will yourself to dominate a niche, can you?
No, would that you could, but no, I don't think you can.
So anyway, just a couple days after, there was another even more fascinating piece published on Substack by the novelist Lincoln Michelle, examining these same questions from a different angle. How do cultural trends actually work and how do they change? In other words, is Jodi Picoult really the Charles Dickens of our time? So I called Lincoln up to talk to him about this, and this is what he had to say. Lincoln Michelle, thanks for taking some time to talk to us today.
Thanks for having me.
So I really enjoyed that piece that you wrote for your Substack, Countercraft, about, you know, kind of the longevity of literature, what survives into posterity and what doesn't and why. And I guess other than being middle-aged like myself, what made you decide to write about that?
Oh, you know, well, the nice thing about having a Substack is you can kind of just write about whatever, you know, pet peeves you have or whatever things you want to rant about. But there was, I just seen some and had been in some discussions about this kind of question, and particularly the question about whether there's certain categories of literature that survive better. You know, is it the populist writers who survive or the critical darlings who survive? So I was in some of those conversations, and I was also reading, just to shout it out, a smart article I thought in the Washington Post by the writer Michael Derda, who had like revisited his picks for longevity and said what he got right and wrong. And so just thinking about the topic that way.
I love that piece. I thought it was so charming and humane, you know? It was interesting that Derrida wrote that because, you know, there was a time when critics thought that part of their purpose was to determine which works were going to survive, right? Like, a work of art couldn't be called great with a capital G unless the critic really thought future generations would also think it was great with a capital G. It seems to me like there was a time when we thought about things through that lens, and that time has sort of gone away, maybe.
I think you're right, but I also think the time like wasn't that long ago. I mean, one thing I wrote in the Substack piece that I find interesting is just how quickly these cultural conversations can change. So like when I was in college in the early aughts, so not that long ago, or not that long ago to me, the idea that literary fiction and genre fiction were like separate categories that never overlapped was still kind of common. And I think almost no one thinks that way today. You know, you get sci-fi and horror books competing for the Pulitzer Prize these days.
Yeah, I mean, you look at like those essays that people like, you know, Jonathan Lethem and Michael Chabon were writing in the early aughts. You know, it's almost like a huge paradigm shift has gone on since then, in part because of them.
Or the whole debate around when books are middlebrow or not. Right. Remember, there was like a big scandal about whether Donna Tartt's The Goldfinch was too middlebrow to win the Pulitzer. And it's hard to even imagine someone writing that article today.
We don't even have brows anymore. We just have very long bangs and then our eyes. There's no highbrow, there's no lowbrow, there's no middle. So, you know, your piece is in part about the big myths we have about posterity, right? So what are those myths that we carry around about what lasts and what doesn't?
Well, I do think, you know, in the more recent history, there's become a narrative that the things that last are maybe the things that were massively popular at the time. And it's maybe part of this, you know, trend that we call poptimism now, which at one point I think meant something that I think we can all agree with, which is that sometimes really popular art is as good as anything that's not, you know, that's critically acclaimed and very valuable. But it's kind of moved into the idea that only what is popular is good and anything else must have something flawed about it. And yeah, I do have a particular pet peeve related to that, which is just the way that we sometimes impose our modern categories and modern frameworks in art and in all aspects of life. But here, you know, I was talking about art on past context when those categories were just not how people thought about things. Mm-hmm. So an example of that I talked about is that I often see writers say that, you know, now famous writers such as Jane Austen was a populist who wrote for the masses, that she's the equivalent of, say, modern day romance writers. And I say this with no, you know, critique of romance at all, but that's not how, you know, her books were thought of at the time. And in reality, her books didn't sell that well. They went out of print quickly, but she had a big fan base of aristocratic opinion makers, including apparently the Prince Regent, who later became, you know, the king. So she was really celebrated by the literal elite. Calling her a writer for the masses is almost exactly wrong.
There's also a period of time where what does writing for the masses even mean when you're talking about the literacy rates of the era in question, right?
Right. And I said that in the piece, but, you know, it's my understanding that in that time period, most books, including books that, you know, were thought of as doing well, were printed in editions of a couple hundred or something. So, yeah, what does it even mean to talk about the mass market when that's the market?
Yeah. Lincoln, that's a really great point. And I should just say to listeners that Lincoln, June, and I will have much more to say about posterity after this break.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
Listeners, June here. I want to remind you that if you are enjoying Working Overtime, please subscribe so that you never miss an episode. They're all good. And if you listen on Apple Podcasts, we would love for you to rate or review the show. It really does help people to find us. And if Overcast is your app of choice, as it is for me, and I believe it is for Isaac too, please hit the star to recommend the episode to others.
Welcome back. So were you surprised by anything you discovered while writing this piece?
Well, no, but only because when I say that it's a pet peeve, I mean, that's something I've like read about and ranted about before. So I've looked this stuff up. But I do think it's illuminating to look at the like the bestseller list. And you can find these on Wikipedia from decades past. There's like the Publishers Weekly's bestseller lists of the 20s and the 30s and the 1910s and whatever you might look at. And just seeing how many of those names not only are completely unfamiliar, but how many of the links are dead. Right. No one has even bothered to create a Wikipedia page about someone who was a bestseller 100 years ago.
Yeah. And it's now, of course, you know, because this podcast isn't only about writing, it's worth saying that's not the only art form that's true of, right? You know, I mean, you read old coverage of visual art and you'll be like, who's this painter? I've never heard of this painter. And they were a big deal in the 1960s or whatever.
Yeah. I think it's true of all art forms.
So here's a question. Should we care about posterity at all? I mean, we'll all be dead by the time it's determined whether Jodi Picoult is our time's Charles Dickens or whatever, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing that I said in the piece, and I feel like on one level this feels like a cop-out, but I also think it's true, is that you just have no idea what's going to last, right? You know, obviously you have pretty famous examples like H.P. Lovecraft, who, you know, has plenty of problems, but certainly has endured as a big influence, who died, you know, in poverty. You have writers like Franz Kafka, who didn't even publish most of their work that's now celebrated today. Or, you know, a book like The Confederacy of Dunces was only published after, you know, Jonathan Kennedy O'Toole's death, and so on and so forth. And then I do think that for me, and, you know, I think we're probably roughly the same age, maybe you feel the same way, but having now, you know, been an adult for a while, just seeing how quickly writers or artists in any art form fall in and out of favor. Yeah. It can happen pretty rapidly. The people who were the big names when I was in college in the 2000s, and I'm talking about past authors, right, not just contemporaries then, many of them are not really discussed anymore.
Yeah, I mean, no one reads Norman Mailer, right? No one reads John Updike, except to dunk on them. Or, well, Patricia Lockwood, I guess, reads John Updike, but no one else reads John Updike. But it's interesting that you bring that up because, you know, I feel like we're in this really dangerous place right now, specifically right now when it comes to cultural preservation, because, you know, you read these statistics about how much of culture, how much of the arts we're actually losing all the time, whether it's you know, streaming services taking TV shows off. And of course, then they're never issued on DVD and who knows what happens to them. Something like 80% of video games from the 1980s don't really exist anymore. But also like a lot of the old weird art projects that people were making on the internet are gone forever. You know, they're flash animated or whatever, and no one has flash right now. And then as a cultural historian, I worry about, you know, 50 years from now, what are people going to do when they write about our time and no one kept a diary and no one sent anyone a letter, right? You know, I mean, do you think about this in terms of cultural preservation and, you know, what do we do? How do we protect the present for the future?
I mean, I totally agree with you. And that's another thing that's interesting, how quickly it's changed, right? Because 20 years ago, it was don't put anything online that you don't want to be on there forever. And now it's like, oh, the project that I worked on forever is gone.
This is going to sound like crazy, and I'm sure I'll get an angry listener email about this. But, you know, you think about something like Succession, right, which dominated the media discourse for the final 2 months of its run. No one talks about it anymore. It just went off the air like 3 weeks ago, right? There is like, it's no longer in the conversation at all. It's very strange how quickly we burn through stuff and then don't save it.
Yeah, and I think that's especially true of TV. I mean, obviously, a million people have talked about our endless streaming services era that we're in. But yeah, it's much harder for things to break through on that front. I feel the same way about movies. I feel like movies are constantly in theaters and I hear people talk about them for a week and then they're out.
I guess this brings me to what we do as creative artists, how we should approach history, how we think about it. Is it just a burden to think about what the future will make of our work when the Body Scout, your wonderful sci-fi novel, were writing it, you know, are you thinking about, I'm in the conversation of sci-fi, or is that something that's just like a huge burden to think about how the future is going to approach your work?
You know, I don't think about the future. I do think about the past a lot in the way that you just framed it, actually, which is to say when I'm writing in genres, I like to think about writing in a tradition in the sense that I am in a conversation with these other authors who have published, and hopefully I'm adding something new to the conversation.
But do you think about being that person for, you know, in 15 years, someone's like, I want to write a sci-fi novel that somehow deals with sports. And, you know, I'm going to be in conversation with the Body Scout or whatever.
I don't think about it because I feel like I just don't know what to think there. You know, I was just thinking about this when you asked me to be on this podcast, but I was thinking about how when COVID-19 hit, all these plague novels, you know, came back and became bestsellers again. Camus' The Plague, which I loved back in the day, but obviously has been eclipsed by Myth of Sisyphus and The Stranger. And even more recent books like Ling Ma's Severance, right? That book came back a bestseller because of this freak event. And, you know, there's no way to predict that kind of stuff. And, you know, maybe some sports league like what I depicted in the book will get pitched or something and mine will come back. But, you know, who knows about that?
Yeah. I mean, in a weird way, I wonder if maybe the converse is true, right? Maybe it's really freeing to know that there's like really fuck all you can do that's going to ensure that anyone cares about anything you made 20 years from now, right? Like you just have no control over it.
Well, and I think if we're being, you know, honest and a bit depressing, when we're talking about literature, you know, if literature is going to really endure in 20, 50 years, most likely it's because there's like a movie adaptation people like or something, which is even more out of your hands. You know, what can you do to ensure that?
You know, when you think of the artists who are sort of most successful at crafting that kind of legacy and longevity, right, the ones who do it intentionally, you know, they're often great masters at the end of their life and they spend some significant portion of the end of that life trying to make sure that legacy is secure. You know, like Stephen Sondheim only finished one musical in the entire 21st century. He only died a couple years ago. And that's largely because, you know, he was so focused on protecting his legacy and making sure that his version of his life story was the one that everyone knew. And that, you know, like he had sort of dictated his own terms for his survival.
And another thing like that I was thinking about was the, you know, the late great Cormac McCarthy, who, you know, I would like to think would survive, but he's a good example of doing what you need to do perhaps to survive. Again, I'm assuming, but he kind of had to do, in my view, like three things. One is write really critical darling books that literary insiders like, but that didn't sell.
Right.
He did that for decades and decades. Then he wrote bestsellers because he had All the Pretty Horses became a bestseller and The Road. And then he had to have huge movie adaptations do well, like No Country for Old Men. And I think the combination of those three will secure his legacy. But so much of that is up to luck and chance. And yeah, I think it's freeing to not worry about it.
Yeah, I think it could be freeing to not worry about it. And, you know, another thing that I find kind of freeing, you know, if I'm going to give some advice to our listeners here is, you know, if you go to a museum and look through not whatever new show it's got going on, but, you know, look through the collection of the museum, walk through those rooms, you're not going to recognize every name on that wall. And you might actually get a lot out of a painting that you're looking at. And it might not be anyone you've ever heard of, right? And, you know, that really tells you something about not everyone's going to be Vincent van Gogh. I know I'm not, you know, I don't want to say anything about you, Lincoln, but I know I'm not, right? But like, that's okay, right? You're still doing something of value just because it doesn't last forever.
Yeah, and maybe another kind of positive spin on this is you also don't know what's going to last. I mean, nothing of mine has lasted. There hasn't been enough time. But sometimes I've had stories which I thought no one would even publish that then end up becoming, you know, one of my more popular stories. Or I recently sold an option for a TV show for something that I thought would never get published. Now, the TV show probably won't ever happen. But if it does, that'll end up being my legacy. And it was a story I almost didn't even send to anyone.
And also, it gave you, you know, a few $1,000 so you can keep working on the next thing. I mean, that's not nothing, right?
No, that is very useful.
One last thing, of course, is that a lot of us, you included, are doing a lot of writing in an ephemeral space. Substack is going to go out of business someday, right? You know, our tweets are going to be lost. Our blue skies, what are we calling them?
Hopefully.
Skeets. Yeah. Posts, whatever they are, lightning bolts, they're going to be gone, right? It's wild how much energy we put into these things where on some level it's like, oh, actually in a year or two, that'll just be like tears and rain.
But you also kind of hope that, right? Like, you know, you read the biographies or the collected works of some great author you love from 50 years ago, and it's their perfectly honed New Yorker pieces. And then it's like, what are they going to have? Are like tossed off typo filled Substacks and tweets? Hopefully not. I hope that stuff disappears.
Well, you know, I had this blog for a long time. It was a theater blog. But one of the reasons why I was able to be so prolific on it is because I didn't edit anything. I didn't even proofread it. I just put it out there, right? And I was very open about that was my process. And that's one of the reasons why it's now password protected and no one will ever read it, right? But an academic recently wrote a book about the theater blogging era. And a few of my posts are reproduced it with my permission, but none of the verbiage has been cleaned up. And I gave her permission to do that. And then one day in a bookstore in England, because it was only published in the UK, I saw the book and I leafed through it and I was like, oh my God, why did I give her permission to do that? I was so furious at her, even though I had told her it was okay, right? So maybe you're right. Maybe we should burn our journals, whatever the digital equivalent is of burning your journals.
Yeah, I mean, it's all weird, right? It's also weird because like when you're working in like the fields we work in, at least the stuff that I consider like the best stuff that I put the most time into and the most care is most likely not going to be read as much as some Substack article I tossed off in an hour that went semi-viral.
Yeah, totally.
It's like the stuff you don't care about, or even just, you know, the dumbest tweet I've written has certainly been read more times than my most carefully honed short story.
Yes, that is definitely true. Well, Lincoln, thank you so much for taking a little time to talk to us about your great piece.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Can you once again tell people where they can find you online and read some of your stuff?
Yeah, well, my Substack is countercraft.substack.com. It's free to sign up for, so feel free to sign up. Otherwise, I'm on various social media sites that are rapidly propagating and rapidly collapsing, so I don't even need to throw my handles there.
And Lincoln's wonderful sci-fi novel, The Body Scout, is available from wherever you can get your books. It's still in print. It's really great. You'll have a lot of fun reading it. Lincoln, thank you again.
Thank you.
So, June, this conversation I had with Lincoln, I actually found it really helpful because, I don't know, like I'm middle-aged now. Things like a legacy or posterity or whatever, they do loom a little bit larger in my mind. I've got more years in the rearview mirror than I probably have ahead.
Oh.
But you really can't predict how any of that's going to work, can you?
No, you cannot. I've been thinking about this a lot recently because I've been researching feminist bookstores from the 1970s through the 90s. In the USA and Canada, these stores were part of a movement of publishers and writers who were agitating to expand the range of books that got published and then to get them into more readers' hands. And things did change. The canon expanded. I should note that there were always some populations who did not see their lives in print, and still waiting for that. But 40 or so years later, most of those books that these women managed to get into print are now out of print. So it's striking how cyclical cultural tastes and movements are. Like, you can never rest on your laurels, you know?
Yes, totally. Culture has to be preserved. But for the individual artist, no matter what medium you're working in, this really isn't something that's that much under your control, you know? And I should say that, look, you might not be Jackson Pollock or Stephen Sondheim or, you know, whatever, but that doesn't mean your work doesn't have value.
No, and I think you just have to do your work. This is not something that is productive to think about. Maybe you and I will be the lasting voices of the 2020s. Maybe. I'm not going to hold my breath, though.
And in some ways, I think that we can take solace from that, that not only can that take the pressure off, but also it's just like the future holds what it's going to hold. You can take care of your work. So maybe in closing, June, I just want to know, who's an artist you love who hasn't been well served by posterity?
I think a lot about journalists. I mean, they can be hugely popular, hugely influential, have a massive impact. But the nature of the work that they do, the nature of their writing, means that unless they also wrote books, they tend not to last. I'm thinking specifically of Janet Flanner, who wrote The New Yorker's Letter from Paris for, I think, 5 decades. Her work has not disappeared. You can find many of her books available on Amazon, for example, even if they are out of print. But she receives far more attention for her biography, for being one of those lesbians who was in Paris between the wars, for being in Paris during World War II, for the people she knew and socialized with, even for some iconic photos she appeared in. So she's still being talked about, but it's not because of her work. And I don't know, this feels something a little bit sad about that. But hey, here we are talking about her on a podcast. Who's your pick for underappreciated talent from the past?
This is one that I think is really interesting. Whenever I speak to a drama class, you know, particularly one that's focused on Shakespeare, I try to bring up Shakespeare's contemporaries, the Jacobean playwrights. Mm. And it's really, there's usually only one student per class who's read any Jacobean playwright. And it's really fascinating because, you know, those writers are not as good as Shakespeare. I mean, that's definitely true. But he was far more aesthetically and in terms of content conservative than they were. And so there is a wild, almost kind of Tarantino-esque streak to that work. You know, to give just one example, there's this play called The Revenger's Tragedy, which is sort of a riff on Hamlet. You know, you've got a guy, a lecherous duke has killed his girlfriend, and he disguises himself, infiltrates the duke's coterie, and then gradually picks off the duke's inner circle before murdering the duke, right? Mm. But on top of that, he carries around the skull of his dead girlfriend, and his soliloquies are delivered to the skull of the dead girlfriend. And how he kills the duke, wait, it gets better. How he kills the duke is he says to the duke, I've got this hot lady who's like ready for you to have sex with her. And then he dresses the skull up in the dress and puts poison lipstick where its lips should be so that when the duke kisses the skull, he gets poisoned and dies.
Oh my God. What?
Yes, there's just a wealth of crazy, hilarious, weird, violent, subversive work out there that just people, no one knows about because we put all of our attention onto Shakespeare. And so the Jacobean playwrights for me are really big on this.
Wow.
That is all the time we have for this episode of Working Overtime. But let me leave you with one last piece of advice. Actually, two last pieces of advice. First of all, do not carry around the skull of your murdered girlfriend and poison its lips with lipstick in order to, you know, get revenge. Not a great idea. It doesn't work out for the guy in the Revenger's Tragedy. It won't work out for you. Second piece of advice, why not subscribe to Working wherever you get your podcasts? And if you have ideas for things that you think we could do better, or questions you'd like us to address, or just fulsome praise about how amazing we are, we would love to hear from you. You can send us an email at working@slate.com or give us a ring at 304-933-WORK.
And if you would like to support what we do, sign up for Slate Plus at slate.com/workingplus. you'll get bonus content, including exclusive episodes of Slow Burn and Big Mood, Little Mood. You'll be able to read everything on the Slate site, and you'll be supporting what we do right here on Working.
Thanks as always to Kevin Bendis and to our series producer Cameron Drews, both of whom will live on in the annals of our hearts. We'll be back on Sunday with a brand new episode of Working, and in 2 weeks we'll have another Working Overtime. Until then, get back to work.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.